from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In his 1989 essay, The End of History, political economist and American intellectual Francis Fukuyama created a sensation when he spotted history's end point in capitalist liberal democracy. 15 years later, Francis Fukuyama is bending his mind around a new issue, immigration and assimilation in the West. Quote, it is no exaggeration to say that the assimilation of culturally distinct immigrants will be the greatest social challenge faced by developed democracies, he wrote last week. Exhibit A, he says, is France. Today saw the last of 3 days of fiery debate over a proposed ban of Muslim headscarves in French schools. Muslims now make up 10% of the French population. Their numbers are growing. The ban will speed Muslim integration into mainstream French life, say its supporters. But plenty of Islamic immigrants see it as flat-out discrimination. Fukuyama thinks it is a policy Americans should keep a close eye on. In the post-9/11 world, he says, the United States must closely monitor how fast and effectively its own immigrants are being assimilated into American society. It may not, he says, be fast enough. Tonight on Point, immigration and assimilation in a globalizing world. Is there a lesson for America in the French headscarf debate? Is America and its melting pot beyond the French problem of assimilation? Is immigration producing a more universal, more global American culture, or a more divided one? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Francis Fukuyama, professor of international political economy at Johns Hopkins University and author of many books, including The End of History and The Last Man. His forthcoming book is State Building, Governance and World Order in the 21st Century. His recent essay on immigration entitled Our Foreign Legions appeared in the Wall Street Journal. Good evening and welcome, Francis Fukuyama.
Oh, thank you.
It's great to have you. We'll be joined in a few minutes by Leila Ahmed, professor at the Harvard Divinity School and author of Women and Gender and in Islam. But Francis Fukuyama, I wanted to dig into your essay and your thesis here first. You say that immigration and, in particular, assimilation may be the biggest challenge that, as I read you, Western democracies face in the coming decades. Why?
I think it's a problem because although cultural diversity is a good thing and something that adds to the richness of life, it's also important for any democratic society to have a certain basic common culture. And I think many democracies, particularly in Western Europe, have a particular challenge because they have increasingly large Muslim populations that come from a very different, culturally different part of the world. And the identity of second and third generation Muslims, I think, since September 11th has been in a way revealed to be not nearly as integrated into the mainstream of those societies. And it's a very explosive situation that they're sitting on because every one of these European countries has a major backlash movement, the National Front in France, the Flams Bloc in Belgium, in which and the governments are really sitting on a very explosive situation. And I think ultimately, since nobody is able to really control immigration or keep immigrants out because of some very basic demographic facts, the dropping birth rates of native-born populations, the only way that you're ever going to get people to live together is if there's a greater degree of assimilation, by which I mean, you know, the acceptance of certain, you know, not the stamping out of cultural diversity, but the acceptance of certain basic common, you know, aspects of culture and the idea that immigrants basically identify with the country to which they've immigrated rather than their home countries.
There's a lot to look at there. You draw a distinction between the way the United States has addressed immigration and assimilation in Europe. When we look across the Atlantic, what do you see in Europe that is outside the American pattern?
Well, there's a big diversity within Europe. For example, Germany traditionally based citizenship on ethnicity. You had to have a German mother. They changed the law in the year 2000, but up until that point, if you were a third-generation Turk who had grown up in Germany, spoke no Turkish, it would be harder for you oftentimes to get German citizenship than, let's say, an ethnic German emigrating from Russia who could speak not a word of German.
So you could immigrate, but becoming a citizen was a matter of blood. It wasn't open to non-blood Germans.
That's right. And you know, a lot of Germans will tell you, quite frankly, we're not a country of immigration. We don't expect that Muslim immigrants will ever become Germans. We will respect them as Turks.
So did that mean the Germans were also not interested in assimilation?
Well, I think ultimately that's the case, that the idea is that you'd have a multiculturalism in which you get these different cultural groups living side by side, but there really would be a very clear distinction between German and non-German. Now, as I said, under the Schröder government, there was a major change in that citizenship law, so it is now much easier for a Muslim to become a full German. But again, they, I think, really regard culture as a certain kind of culture is key to identity, and it's very difficult to accept other people into that.
And then there's France.
France is a very different country. It's much more like ours. They have a strong republican tradition in which citizenship is really defined politically. If you accept the French political system, you speak French, they will accept you. You know, Léopold Senghor, the great Senegalese poet, was admitted to the Académie Française. I always thought this was a very impressive thing back in the 1950s. He was black, but he could speak. You know, he wrote beautifully in French, and you know, there was a universalism to French citizenship that really does not exist in some other continental European countries.
It depended on individuals, not groups, citizenship.
The French Republican tradition does not recognize communal rights of religious groups or ethnic groups subordinate to the French state. Everybody is treated equally as an individual.
Now, the French Parliament, we understand, has just completed 3 days of debate of this law, which would, I guess the exact language is still under debate, but it would ban conspicuous religious symbols or visible religious symbols. So it's not clear exactly yet what this would cover, whether it's just headscarves or headscarves and perhaps Jewish skullcaps, or perhaps both of those plus crucifixes, the exact language that will make a difference here. But why has France been so concerned about this? 10% of France, the French now Muslim, as you say, tens of thousands of Muslim school children. But we read everywhere only a few hundred, 1,000 at most, of those Muslim school children wearing the hijab, the traditional headscarf. Why is that such a big deal in a country of 50 or 60 million people?
I think that it's really at this point has a more symbolic significance than anything else. There's been a return to headscarves across the Muslim world as a result of the rise of religion and religious identity, some of it connected to fundamentalism. And I think that the French are simply worried that they're at the beginning of a large trend. Now, I want to say I do not know whether this French policy is actually a wise one. Many people will argue that it's going to be very counterproductive.
How so?
Well, it will produce a big reaction. It already has. I mean, there have been demonstrations all over France, Europe, the Middle East against this policy.
And not just from Muslims, we should say.
Not just from Muslims. And it may have the effect of actually driving Muslims, observant Muslims, out of the public school system into their own Muslim schools. And in a way, that could make the problem worse. So I'm not here to, I'm not siding with the French policy necessarily, but I do think that we need to understand that it is very much in this French Republican tradition that basically makes a bargain with immigrants, which says you can be fully French and have all of the rights of a French citizen if you accept, you know, the political conditions for that. Now, the law itself has all these little, you know, inconsistencies. So, you know, a small crucifix is okay, but not the, you know, the headscarf.
But the fundamental problem here, you say French foreign policy is already being swayed by its Muslim population. Is that a bad thing? America has a long history of its foreign policy being swayed by ethnic populations here in many decades, centuries.
No. There's, you know, that's not... That's perfectly legitimate for ethnic groups to influence foreign policy as they see fit. I do think that it is one of the things that's really driving the European-American split that became so evident in the debate over the Iraq War. If you look at the way that, for example, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is covered in Europe, in particularly a place like France, compared to the United States, is as if you're looking at two completely different conflicts where the emphasis in terms of the suffering of the Palestinians is you know, played up a great deal in Europe and that of, you know, Israeli victims of suicide bombings in the United States.
In your Wall Street Journal essay, pin the sort of wave of anti-Semitic incidents in Europe to Muslim populations there. You even say that September 11th revealed, quoting you, that assimilation is working very poorly in much of Europe. How so?
Well, there were some very revealing incidents. There was a soccer game between the French and Algerian national teams shortly after September 11th in which the crowd of fans for the Algerian team were mostly second and third generation North Africans, booed during the Marseillaise and chanted, you know, Osama bin Laden's name. And
I mean, things happen at football games, though. It's more than that. You also point to a kind of radicalization of Muslims in Europe that's gone on, not necessarily in Afghanistan or in Saudi madrasas, but in Europe.
That's absolutely right. If you look at the September 11th hijackers, the ringleaders, people like Mohammed Atta that organized the attack, were all radicalized in Western Europe. And I think what that tells us is that there is actually something, you know, deeply alienating about the experience of actually being a middle-class aspiring engineering student in a place like Hamburg or in Paris, you know, in one of these suburbs of Paris, seems to make that, you know, a very hostile territory and breeds a kind of deep alienation that in these cases led to this extreme of actual active participation in terrorism.
So what's the lesson for the United States here? I mean, the United States has dealt with centuries of immigration, many waves of immigration. It clearly has not always been easy. In fact, it's been difficult. It's even been bloody sometimes. But over the sweep of history, it has worked again and again and again to this country's benefit by practically everyone's assessment. So maybe this is Europe's problem, not America's.
Well, it's immigration has been a tremendous asset to the United States. It gives us vitality and economic dynamism and a whole lot of things. But I think it has worked because we are really an assimilation powerhouse as a society. We, like the French, base our citizenship really on politics. I mean, if you accept the Constitution and the laws of the United States, you know, you can qualify, and it doesn't matter what your skin color or religion are. And that's been, you know, what's made our system work. But I think it's pretty clear that in the last generation there have been a lot of backlash movements to that, of ethnic identity movements.
Multiculturalism.
Is
that a problem or a good thing?
Well, I guess it really depends on how you define it. I think that nobody wants to live in a white bread society in which, you know, everybody behaves like a, you know, an old line wasp, you know. I think it is also the case that the moment that ethnicity takes on a, you know, very strong political dimension, and in which you get communal demands being raised, where people are not treated or don't want to be treated as individuals but as members of groups, then I think it undercuts a very basic, you know, theoretical point about American liberalism.
We'll talk about whether that's really an issue in the United States from immigrant groups. I guess since you're raising France and Europe, we've got to look at the Muslim population in particular. But gosh, it also, doesn't it raise your antenna as well of concern? I mean, Francis Fukuyama, you of Japanese descent, presumably, mm-hmm. We know what happened with the Japanese during World War II. There are moments where this kind of suspicion, singling out of groups, scrutiny turns into oppression.
Oh, that's absolutely right. My relative spent the war in a relocation center in Colorado. So I think it's...
Are you concerned that this kind of talk about Muslims in Europe or in the United States may push toward... I mean, there's already been concern since 9/11 about that kind of dynamic, if not that scale, in the U.S.
It already has. There are these extreme right-wing, you know, basically fascist groups like the National Front in France that articulate a very racist doctrine. And I think the problem in those countries is that the mainstream politicians, you know, center-right politicians like Chirac, because they do not want to legitimize the extreme right, have been deathly afraid of raising, you know, issues like the relationship between immigration and crime or this whole question of are Muslims assimilating adequately. And I think they cannot avoid this issue. I think in order really to fend off the really nasty racist backlash, the mainstream politicians in some sense have to join more honestly and openly into a discussion of this issue.
That's just what we're doing tonight. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about immigration and assimilation in a globalizing world. My guest is Francis Fukuyama of End of History fame. You can join our conversation tonight. Have you watched the headscarf debate in France? What's it really about? Assimilation? Cultural imperialism? Racism? Realism? Is there a lesson, a warning, for the U.S. in the French fracas? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about immigration and assimilation in a globalizing world. You can join our conversation tonight. Have you watched the headscarf debate in France? What is that debate really about? Is it about assimilation, about cultural imperialism, about racism, about realism? Is America immune to the French problem? Are we beyond it? Or is it still coming? And do you share Francis Fukuyama's belief in the paramount importance of assimilation? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking tonight with Francis Fukuyama, author of The End of History and The Last Man. He is professor of international political economy at Johns Hopkins University. We're joined now in the studio by Leila Ahmed. She's professor of divinity at the Harvard Divinity School, author of many books, including Women and Gender in Islam, Historical Roots of a Modern Debate. Good evening and welcome, Leila Ahmed.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You've been reading and listening in to the line of thought that Francis Fukuyama is putting out, watching what's going on in France. You know this change looks to be imminent in France, probably next week.
Yes.
School children will be required not to wear conspicuous or visible religious symbols. And, of course, this is, above all, aimed at the Muslim hijab, that some, not that big a number, but some number of young Islamic women, girls, have been wearing in French schools. What's your response to the French move and to Francis Fukuyama's interpretation of what's going on here?
The French move, I think it's actually too complicated because they have a very different notion of what the secular and religious divide. So I can't really speak at great length about that, but I do know that quite a lot of people, both Muslims and non-Muslims, have opposed it in France, including
yes.
feminists,
mm-hmm.
and they've opposed it on the basis that it's really a racist move. It's not about protecting young women as it claims to be doing, but
mm-hmm.
it's really a way of, Christine Delphi, one of the leading feminists, has said it's a way of marginalizing Muslims and devaluing their culture.
And the claim to protection is supposed to be protecting them from an imposition of a fundamentalist religion, or
that's what
the
assumption that it's assumed, and I don't know what on what ground they're doing that. And actually, in Professor Fukuyama's article, which I read, the assumption does seem to me that it's either forced, or if it's not forced, then the young women don't know what they're doing, and they need intelligent people like us to explain what's really going on. And in fact, the evidence really doesn't support this, because at least in America, and I've been interviewing lots of women who do wear hijab, it's very often against their parents' wishes, or it's certainly not imposed on them.
So they're asserting it themselves.
It's asserting it themselves, and it's not by any means sexist. I could give you a couple of examples of the kind of reasons they have given me. For example, someone has said to me that she does it. And I mean, there's a whole complexity as to whether it's required by Islam or not. That if we leave that aside.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They have said things like, well, I wear it for the same reason that my Jewish friends wear a yarmulke, as a way of saying, I am different, but I recognize this prejudice against us in this country, and I'm identifying with a group that is looked down on, and we have a right to be here, and it's a way of drawing attention, people's
mm-hmm.
attention to this fact. It's an anti-racist move, actually.
Well, let's go straight to the heart, then, of Francis Fukuyama's premise here, which is that that Western democracies, and correct me if I get it wrong, but that Western democracies have to watch out to keep immigrant populations assimilating to maintain a kind of political cultural cohesion,
yes.
Lest they run into divisions that hobble them and are destructive. Do you buy that? And within that, I guess we should say, in Europe, he's pointing to a large and growing Muslim population as a kind of wedge problem.
Yes.
Do you accept that?
Well, what struck me about what Professor Fukuyama was saying just now, and about paralleling that America will have to look out for this on this issue too, is you use a phrase that we need a basic common culture. And I have in that connection two or three points. One is regarding the Muslim population of America, 45% at least are African American. So they're American, as American as they come. And in my experience, immigrants, including all the young women who wear hijab, who are born in this country, are also as American as apple pie. So I don't know why exactly you're taking the hijab as a sign that Muslims, there isn't a common culture. Why is it?
I don't think that there's a particular problem with the assimilation of Muslim immigrants in the United States. I think that what I was arguing was that our version of this controversy was really bilingualism in states like Texas and California. Mm-hmm. And in that case, and I think there's some real parallels to it, and I think in that case we did something that was not too different from what the French are trying to do with the hijab, which was to end bilingualism, Proposition 227, that passed a few years ago in California, you know, ended bilingualism in one stroke, and it is a type of forced immigration, and people made
assimilation.
Mm-hmm. People made the same, you know, arguments about speaking Spanish, that it's part of our identity. It's part of, you know, we want to show that we're a mistreated minority, and we, you know, want to identify with that. But I think it is not in the self-interest really of the Hispanic immigrants themselves to be put into this kind of language ghetto.
But you do make this point, Francis Fukuyama, that the success of immigrant populations, and particularly in assimilation, economic success, comes from what you call outmarriage, out of that ethnic group and into the general population. And you draw a line between that and a potential hurdle to that, which does get back to Muslim practice and the hijab, a kind of visible symbol, as you describe it, of sexual control over the daughters of this community. Do you see that as a current or future impediment, or is the American to Muslim assimilation in the United States, or is the U.S. assimilation machine or powerhouse, as you call it, so strong that that's not an issue here?
I suspect that in the United States this is not going to be a problem. I mean, it's partly numbers. It's, you know, the relative size of the population, the Muslim population, is going to be small here. And I do think that it's an attractive culture in many other ways, that I don't regard this as a serious problem really for us.
So Leila Ahmed, when you read this, do you see this as Francis Fukuyama peering ahead and seeing a potential danger for the United States, or do you see it as a kind of threatening perspective toward the, I don't know, the integrity of the Muslim population in Europe, in the U.S.?
Well, I think Professor Fukuyama actually kind of deflected us, and I think he said he's speaking about the Spanish language question, and I do think there's a very different, the issue of language is a very different question. I got the sense from the article of a much more hostile understanding of Muslims than I'm getting right now.
And I have to say, I mean, no one's talking about Mexican terrorists, mm-hmm. These kind of associations that have been made
That's
since 9/11.
Right. Yes.
The weight of this article, Our Foreign Legions, does lean on the difference between the U.S. treatment of immigrants, but particularly this population. But I think the same question applies, whether or not the inestimable Professor Fukuyama wholly accepts it. If you take the weight of this essay, as I guess I have to say I read it, and perhaps you did,
yes.
And it's easy to see how it's translated that way. Is this the way to enlightenment or to something less welcome?
What, to restrict? To
the notion that we have to, that the countries must watch out to be sure that everybody's assimilating, and Europe in particular needs to watch out for Muslims, and perhaps the United States should too.
Well, I mean, all that is very troubling, the notion of watching out for Muslims, because Muslims are, I think it's really actually the context in which we're speaking that is making this more loaded than it is, because very commonly in the U.S. press, I have to say, mm-hmm. Muslims are depicted as if we're a bunch of hordes, all of us thinking the same way, that there isn't a vast spectrum of secular to religious, and indeed within the religious there are huge disputes. So that the fact that we're speaking in this context, I think, gives his essay an edge which he wouldn't have, doesn't necessarily have.
But the edge is there, and it's real. Muslim men have been rounded up since 9/11
indeed,
in quite extraordinary ways.
That's right.
So I think the question remains, is the answer for, he's saying, United States, watch Europe and learn, remember the importance of assimilation. Is this a lesson that needs particular application as the world becomes more globalized, as immigrants become a more and more important part of the U.S. economy, as the Native Americans, American-born citizens age? Is it particularly important around the Muslim community somehow, or is that an affront?
I'm partly divided because I didn't hear Professor Fukuyama saying that right now. So
well, I wasn't saying that. I actually think that the way that Muslim men have been treated, since September 11th is terrible, and you know, my own family's experience during World War II, I think, makes me particularly, you know, sensitive to it. Mm-hmm. I really think that that's a separate issue, though. I mean, what I'm saying is that what we have had in this country is this bargain with immigrants that say, if you accept certain basic conditions, mm-hmm. we will fully accept you as Americans, and it doesn't matter what your religion is, it doesn't matter what your skin color, your ethnicity is. And that is the core of what we need to preserve, and that's what I think the Europeans do much, much less well. And the result is you have poorly assimilated minority populations and big backlash movements that really, you know, feel that they're fundamentally foreigners. And I think that it is worth, you know, really avoiding that, the development. I don't think that exists
You're saying,
here.
Let's not go there.
Let's not go there. Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. I'd like to invite them in. Raj is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Raj. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling to point out a couple of items. Number one is that the immediate post-colonial period saw a mature population in the Islamic world that had been in touch with the colonial powers and with Western culture.
Mm-hmm.
The new generation, which has grown up in the and matured in the post-colonial period, have not had as much opportunity for understanding Western culture.
And what should we take from that, Raj? What's the implication?
Well, what we should take from that is to try to understand where they are coming from. And I think one of the most fundamental issues from my perspective, and I was born a Christian Arab in Jerusalem, and mm-hmm. I've been in the United States for 50 years, the fact that we recognize and acknowledge the contribution of the Jewish population to Western culture. We do not recognize the contribution of Islamic civilization in bridging between the Greco-Roman mm-hmm. era and the Renaissance. And that is a very important factor. Many of the young people there are aware of it. They're aware of their own history and their traditions, the contribution of the arts, of philosophy, and so on, to Western culture. And one... in the West has the impression that these are totally denied and ignored.
Raj, when you look at France and see what's been going on there with this debate over the ban on headscarves for young Muslim women, girls, what do you make of it?
Well, I'll be candid with you. I have a friend who's an obstetrician up in Appleton, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and his wife, within the past 10 years, who's been studying the Old Testament, New Testament, and the Quran, decided to start wearing the hijab as an expression of her faith.
So is this a beautiful thing, or is this an offense to assimilation?
No. I grew up in the Middle East. My grandmother, who was a Christian, always wore a shawl on her head before she ever went out. I mean, it's part of the tradition of that culture. My grandfather used to wear a robe, you know, and when my parents said, when my father and uncle suggested he wear Western clothes, he told them to go to hell. I mean, it was the tradition of that culture.
Can you ever imagine a time that the United States might come to, as France now has, where it would, to urge assimilation, ban ethnic or religious dress, Raj?
No, I don't see that because, for example, in this country, I've never seen a willingness to impose on public schools the wearing of uniforms, which is done in private schools.
Mm-hmm.
In public schools, it doesn't happen, and I can't see that being imposed on a larger. I think the dignity of the individual and the independence of the individual is more highly valued here than it is in most European cultures.
Raj, thanks very much for your call. Lil Ahmed, here's this concern about respect for Islamic culture and awareness and acknowledgement of Islamic culture in the U.S. In this whole conversation about assimilation and social cohesion, are these code words in some way for pushing away the other, for not acknowledging other cultures?
I think it is, but actually the caller made what I thought was an important point, which is that he spoke about being from Christian background
mm-hmm.
and having, in other words, exactly the same customs as
right.
whether you're Muslim
right.
or
right.
Christian. So I think it's one of the great false divides that we're making. It's as Christianity is, of course, as indigenous to that region as is Islam, and the customs that we have are from both traditions. So we're living through a kind of very falsifying time in which we're trying to represent Islam as the other,
yes.
when it has been integrally part of the history of Europe.
Raj's point
yes.
to the whole intellectual
That's right.
foundation,
That's right.
not to mention the interactions. Imran is calling from Ashland, Massachusetts. Hi, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi. You know, I just wanted to make the point that I think in America, and probably you could say France and Britain, you know, there's this attitude that I see of basically, you know, talking the talk but not really being able to walk the walk.
What do you mean by that?
Well, so, you know, on the one hand, we talk about, you know, having civil liberties and that, you know, equality under the law, and everybody, you know, this is a great melting pot, and we respect other cultures, but the truth of the matter really is that we're not really all that tolerant, and when somebody from another culture decides that they want to maybe dress differently or express their faith or whatever, we have a very hard time trying to assimilate that in. And it, you know, I mean, to pick, I guess, maybe a slightly different topic, I mean, look at the issue of gay marriages. I mean, we're, you know, we're having a hard time trying to apply, you know, equal protection under the law to a group of people who look like everybody else.
So there's plenty going on many fronts. But what about on this particular front of immigrants and assimilation? Is assimilation important in your mind, Imran?
Well, you know, I'm a Muslim, and I grew up in this country my entire life. And, you know, my impression is that, you know, my parents who emigrated here, you know, they assimilated into the country. They've been here for 40 years, and I grew up as not a very religious person, but actually became more religious as I grew up. And I find that people do assimilate. But I think that the more important point that I wanted to pick up was the issue of disenfranchisement of members of society. And I think that when you look at France and Britain and the extremist elements that have arisen out of those groups, it's because of disenfranchisement of that population. They tend to live in ghettos. They tend to be discriminated against jobs. And I think when I look at what's going on in America, I think we're headed in that direction. I read the Wall Street Journal, the editorial page of the journal, as well as people like Daniel Pipes and you know, I think Richard Perle.
And are you talking about immigrants in general or Muslim immigrants?
Well, they pick on Muslim immigrants because that tends to be the, you know, the people to pick on now. You know?
Imran, we've got it. Our time is short before the break. Francis Fukuyama, is this speaking to your region of concern?
No, I think that when you talk about tolerance and individual freedom, you know, there are different kinds of threats to it. One is the one from the state, but, you know, the other can be from the culture itself. And one of the points I made in the article was that this is not a Muslim tradition, but it is culturally, I think, characteristic of many immigrants from Middle Eastern societies. There's a great emphasis on cousin marriage and a great desire on the part of the families to control the sexuality of their daughters and whom they marry and whether they can marry outsiders. And that, in the long run, has a tremendous impact on ultimate assimilation.
Francis Fukuyama, Leila Ahmed with me tonight. We're talking about immigration and assimilation in a globalizing world. You can join the conversation. Is immigration producing a more universal American culture or a more divided one? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about immigration and assimilation in a globalizing world. My guests tonight are Francis Fukuyama, professor of international political economy at Johns Hopkins University, author of upcoming book, State Building, Governance, and World Order in the 21st Century. His op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal last week was entitled Our Foreign Legions. Also with us tonight, Leila Ahmed, professor of divinity at the Harvard Divinity School and author of Women and Gender in Islam. You can join our conversation tonight. Is there a lesson, a warning for the United States in the French headscarf debate? And how how assimilated does a healthy national population need to be? Does the U.S. have the right balance or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Edward is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Edward. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thank you for letting me make my comment and ask a question. I'll preface it by saying I lived in France until recently for about 18 years, and this same debate about the hijab or foulard, as they call it, occurred about 10 years ago, and it was quickly resolved because it was primarily, I would say, exclusively focused on young girls in the public schools, and it goes back to the origin of the modern public school at the turn of the last century, the beginning of the last century. I won't get into the details. I imagine Dr. Fukuyama can expand on that, but there was fundamentally a crisis between the influence of the Catholic Church and secularism and Jules Ferry.
An old French conflict.
Yeah, exactly. And the French resolved it essentially by secularizing the school in some ways to an extreme. My wife is French and comes from a teaching family background, and she has different views on this than I do, but fundamentally it goes back to that tradition. And 10 years ago when it occurred, it was held in that context, and it did not become the major crisis that it has today.
So why such a crisis now?
Well, that's my observation, and frankly, I've been following it in the press, but not as closely as I could have, and I didn't read Dr. Fukuyama's article, so I'd be interested in his comment, is I saw two things in the press last week or so when it occurred. One was that this clearly seemed to be an escalation on the part of the Chirac government by not only including the schools, but by attempting to include the public workplace as a place where primarily Muslim people would not be able to practice their how can I put it, exhibit their faith. I don't know to what degree it actually went to prayer and things like that. And on the other hand, I'm sad to say that the manifestation or the protests in Paris actually was manipulated and degraded into a rather ugly anti-Semitic and anti-Israeli protests.
These protests against the ban on the hijab, you're saying?
Yeah, the protest against the ban on the hijab, which was legitimate on the part, I believe, on the part of ordinary young, let's say, Muslim girls in France,
because
it primarily applies to girls, who want to wear a modest hijab in the classroom. It was manipulated in part through provocation, frankly, but also with other goals in mind, into a rather ugly protest.
Edward, we'll get Francis Fukuyama's response, but let me just ask you, with your long time in France, what do you make of the ban? Do you think that it's a reasonable effort to speed assimilation or an imposition on one part of the population? Edward, are you there?
Oh, are you asking me?
Yes, I am.
Well, this is interesting. My simple answer is I personally believe, coming from an American tradition, that exhibitions of religious faith in a very limited sense are part of a person's identity, but that there is a limit. On the other hand, my wife and her family believe that there is a very sharp barrier. If I can make one other point, and then I'd be interested in getting Dr. Fukuyama's reaction. One of my concerns in this country is that we're reintroducing religion into public functions, you know, the simple question of faith-based prison reform programs and these kinds of things will do nothing more than confuse those people who are asked to assimilate but who don't want to give up their basic faith.
Yeah.
So they're told essentially, you know, and I think the problem is that there is a sort of underlying prejudice towards Christian programs, and maybe that's wrong, but maybe that's a false assumption.
Edward, you've given us a lot, and our time is short. Let Francis Fukuyama pick it up.
Well, you know, I think that the reason that this time around it's a much sharper debate was really because of the 2002 French presidential election. Jean-Marie Le Pen came in with 17% of the vote, second after he beat the socialist Jospin.
With his very conservative nationalist line.
And I think it really shocked and scared the French political class that they were riding this tiger in terms of this backlash movement, and that they would have to now take seriously some of the concerns. And one of the important concerns of the extreme right is crime, because there is this correlation between immigrant communities and crime in France. And so Chirac responded by appointing this very tough justice minister, Nicolas Sarkozy. There have been other, you know, all sorts of crackdowns. It's a little bit like Giuliani in New York, you know, crackdowns on all sorts of petty crime and prostitution and so forth. But I think the headscarf policy, in a way, is very consistent with that, because part of what it's trying to do in France is to appease that extreme right. You know, in that sense, it's not a very attractive policy. They're trying to steer, you know, a path between the extreme right and yet keep the, you know, the
basic. In other words, this isn't about assimilation. It's about oppression. It's about keeping the other, the immigrant, out of the face of the nationalist conservatives.
It's more complicated than that. I think they really want to forestall a really big blow-up, you know, over this. And how you do that tactically is a really complicated question, because sometimes it involves fighting, you know, and Chirac really did fight Le Pen.
Yes.
But on the other hand, sometimes it means conceding part of the issue, you know, to your opponents.
And maybe in a tangential way that works in a couple of ways. And what about our caller Edward's observation about the rising public profile of Christianity in the United States Does that create a problem for assimilation? You're asking groups to assimilate, and then the core culture is perhaps less secular and more religious than it had been.
Well, I mean, I think that this, you know, should actually give us a certain amount of sympathy for the French situation because, you know, over the last 30, 40 years, we've been very ruthless in eliminating, you know, overt displays of religiosity from any public place. Precisely on this, you know, on very familiar grounds. Mm-hmm. And so we have our own experience with this kind of secularism, sort of militant secularism.
Yes, we do. Let's get one more call. Shrida's calling from Boston. Hi, Shrida, you're on the air.
Hi. My comment was that assimilation is going to be a problem because especially in case, from my own experience, especially in case of Islamic cultures, the people tend to identify themselves as Muslims first, then the nation... wherever they belong. I mean, I would say I'm from India first, and then I would say I'm a Hindu. Rather, I would find the opposite in the other places, you know, regardless of where they come from. I'm Muslim first, and then I belong to Jordan or wherever it may be. And that is going to be a fundamental problem in assimilation because there is no the nationalistic feeling or the community feeling is far below in the rung of things rather than the religious feeling.
Got it. You're not Muslim, but that's your observation. Leila Ahmed, what do you say?
I don't see that's the case at all. I think how people identify has varied from time to place and time, and perhaps Muslims from India identify first as Muslim, and I don't really know what the situation is, but that really makes no sense. And I think it's really about prejudice that's underlying there because... for instance, people from the Arab world, whether they're Christian or Muslim, are often accused of being identifying first as Arab instead of being calling themselves Christian
right,
or Muslim.
Right.
So I think labeling people as this or that and therefore unassimilable is a very dangerous thing to do.
Since the reaction to 9/11, what's your sense? Is the United States writing itself in its relationship with its Islamic citizens? Do we have the right relationship that makes them feel embraced, integrated, or is there an alienating process going on?
I think the public process and largely the media process has been profoundly alienating.
And continues to be so.
And the costs to Muslims has been devastating. I mean, the arrests, the deportations, all of those things that have happened have been devastating. There's no doubt about my mind about the terrible costs and the cost to America, I think, of such bigotry and such lack of discrimination is devastating. But I need to say that I think there's a huge difference between what happened on the public level and even on the media level and on the personal level. And just take the hijab issue.
Yes.
You know, women were attacked in various
places.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, lots of ordinary Americans kind of came to their support. There were organizations formed to escort services for women in hijab.
Right.
There were towns that put on headscarves in their support. So I think there is, among Americans as a whole, there is a very deep will to hold on to what is best about America, which is to accept everybody and allow people to do whatever they want to do so long as they're not harming anybody. But I think the public discourse has been profoundly damaging, profoundly mistaken.
Well, there's a lot to watch here. Francis Fukuyama, I want to thank you for raising the issue and for joining us in the conversation tonight.
Thank you very much.
Francis Fukuyama, Professor of International Political Economy at Johns Hopkins University, and Leila Ahmed, wonderful to have you and your perspective. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Leila Ahmed, Professor of Divinity at the Harvard Divinity School. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the former U.S. Chief Weapons Inspector in Iraq, David Kaye, on what most frightened him about Iraq's weapons program. This is On Point. Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf today pardoned the founder of Pakistan's nuclear weapons program, Abdul Qadir Khan, who has admitted to spreading nuclear weapons technology to Libya, Iran, and North Korea. Meanwhile, in Washington, the former chief U.S. weapons inspector in Iraq, David Kay, sounded a warning that the potential for proliferation is the real danger that he found in Iraq. Kay also lashed out at those like Donald Rumsfeld, who continue to suggest that weapons of mass destruction will still be found in Iraq. Here's an excerpt of Kay's address to the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
I have to say, I'm a little troubled when people say, as they do all the time to me, Baghdad is bigger than L.A., Iraq is the size of California. Aren't there some places that the WMD could be hidden? Well, in one sense, the answer is yes, but what's really insulting to me is the belief that we would design a strategy that relied on searching for the actual weapons themselves once you go beyond the place that your intelligence said they should be. What we did, and I think what anyone would have done in that situation, is say, look, if there were large stockpiles, they had to be produced by people, they had to be produced in facilities, and they would have left some indelible signs. Where are those people? Where are those facilities? Where are the documents, the importation, and the other records of such large production? Those have not been found. And I think those are pretty compelling proof at this point, maybe even the famous 85% level for me, of proof that those don't exist. The nuke program was not resurgent. It is clear that the Iraqis had realized how seriously decayed their capability in this area had gone, and in 2000 they started investing some modest amounts of money in rebuilding facilities, primarily at Tuwaitha, ordering, and clandestinely ordering, let me say, some nuclear equipment. So it was on their mind, but it would be an exaggeration to say this was a resurgent program on the verge of producing its first nuclear weapon or nuclear materials. There was continued R&D in the chemical and biological area. R&D that was not reported to the UN, much R&D that was not discovered during the last UN inspection. And there's multiple Iraqis willing to testify that they were asked by the UN, but they dared not tell the UN the truth the way they would tell the Iraq Survey the truth because of the security service. No great surprise there. The missile area was absolutely an aggressive program, and more aggressive than I must say than I think has been portrayed in the press here. And let me tell you where I think the story is, and one that particularly after Libya, people need to pay attention to. And that was the extent of foreign assistance and foreign procurement. I mean, it's been a wake-up call for me and I think most of my colleagues that exist in this area that essentially AQ Khan had been running a Sam's Club for nuclear weapons. I mean, the knowledge that some of the centrifuge parts were produced at a special factory in Malaysia and then shipped to Libya is absolutely startling, this idea that you outsource production. He wasn't stealing or diverting production in Pakistan. Someone had set up special arrangements. I'm not sure we're not giving AQ more credit than he's due. But in the missile area, what made Iraq so threatening in the program that they really started pushing ahead in late 99, early 2000, was the degree of foreign assistance. And that's one reason the Iraq Survey Group must continue. We need to unravel this foreign procurement network that is now operating around the world and that is giving capabilities to at least states and perhaps to terrorist groups as well to do things that are truly harmful.
Former Iraq Chief Weapons Inspector David Kay speaking earlier today in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.